Okay, it's been a few weeks since we've been in Job, but we're in chapter 39 today, and just going to start by reading it through, actually. It says, "Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the months till they bear? Do you know the time they give birth? They crouch down and bring forth their young. Their labour pains are ended. Their young thrive and grow strong in the wilds. They leave and do not return. Who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied its ropes? I gave it the wasteland as its home, the salt flats as its habitat. It laughs at the commotion in the town. It does not hear a driver's shout. It ranges the hills for its pasture and searches for any green thing. Will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will it stay by your manger at night? Can you hold it to the furrow with a harness? Will it till the valleys behind you? Will you rely on it for its great strength? Will you leave your heavy work? Will you leave your heavy work to it? Can you trust it to haul in the grain and bring it to your threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully, though they cannot compare with the wings and feathers of the stork. She lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them, that some wild animal may trample them. She treats her young harshly as if they were not hers. She cares not that her labour was in vain, for God did not endow her with wisdom or give her a share of good sense. Yet when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider. Do you give the horse its strength or clothe its neck with a flowing mane? Do you make it leap like a locust, striking terror with its proud snorting? It paws fiercely, rejoicing in its strength, and charges into the fray. It laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. It does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against its side, along with the flashing spear and the lance. In frenzied excitement, it eats up the ground. It cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, it snorts. Aha! It catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry. Does the hawk take flight with your wisdom? By your wisdom, and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle soar at your command and build its nest on high? It dwells on a cliff and stays there at night. A rocky crag is its stronghold. From there it looks for food. Its eyes detect it from afar. Its young ones feast on blood. And where the slain are, there it is." So chapter 39 kind of reads like a David Attenborough documentary. Got all this sort of animals doing their thing and descriptions of, you know, what they're like. You could almost imagine David Attenborough reading that passage. I don't have the accent for it, so it's... But, of course, it is poetic language. And one of the things, you've got God asking Job all of these questions. And as we said before, when God asks questions, he's not really looking for information. What he's doing is he's actually causing Job to think about things in order that it might change the way he looks at the world, because he's struggling with this issue of suffering and, you know, why he's going through what he's going through. Back at the end of chapter 38, this picture began to God move from describing water in its different forms and the way he uses water to begin to talk about animals. And we had this picture of a lion cub and ravens, where it says, "Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions when they crouch in the dens or lie in wait in a thicket? Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food?" And what God was doing there was he was drawing attention to redemptive suffering. Remember, we talked about the sort of wildlife situation where you got the young lions and the young ravens, but for them to live and to thrive, because they eat meat, there needs to be a sacrifice that is redemptive in its nature, that it will feed the next generation of lions and ravens. And that drew our attention to the ultimate redeeming sacrifice of Christ. So when we come to look at these animals in chapter 39, well, as I said, it's one thing to sort of look at it and for Job to go, well, yeah, I don't know any of that stuff. You know, I'm not the one that sort of watches over the fawns when they give birth and so on. And there's that sense of awe that's created. But God is really communicating a whole lot more than just showing Job's ignorance, because that's not God's style. He doesn't sort of turn up just to make us feel small. He wants to lead us in the knowledge of him and to understand the way that he's created the heavens and the earth, because it's an expression of his nature, of who he is. So, the first thing we note is that when God is talking to Job about these animals, he's not talking to Job about farm animals. He's talking to him about animals that are wild and that live in an environment that is unpredictable, that is dangerous, that is a place that really is not safe and manageable. And remember that the whole discussion throughout Job is moving from this retributive theology where you can control everything in life and keep it all in nice, neat little paddocks and yards and, you know, and that sort of thing, and have, you know, just trim the edges, keep the weeds back and all that sort of stuff by doing the right thing. But when you go out into the wild, there's, you can't control what's going on around you, that things are unpredictable, that it is unmanageable. And so God is using these wild places, these wild animals, as a way of kind of helping Job to look outside of himself, in a sense. He's saying that, you know, there's stuff in this world which you can't control, which you can't manage. And so as we look at these animals in more detail, we realise that none of them are animals that you would use in a farm. And there's reasons for that. So first up, it says, do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you watch the doe? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the months till they bear? Do you know the time they give birth? They crouch down and bring forth their young. Their labour pains are ended. The young thrive and grow strong in the wilds. They leave and do not return. So we see here that God watches over the birth of wild animals. First thing that he's, you know, as Jesus said, that a swallow doesn't fall from the sky without God knowing about it, that he knows everything about his creation. He's intimately familiar with it. And he knows their purposes and their time, and he's nearby when they're brought forth. But you notice that the birth of the goat, of the doe, happens in pain, because it says that they crouch down and bring forth their young, their labour pains are ended. So we've got this picture of suffering being associated with new life, with birth, because the animals go through labour, and the discomfort of labour is the thing that bears fruit. And so we have a picture here of a redemptive suffering. So, when animals give birth, they don't make much noise. Says here that it's uncomfortable for the animals. I'm not going to go anywhere near saying anything about, those of you that have given birth, then you'd be better off talking about it than me. But what God is communicating is that there's stuff in life that is sort of difficult, but the suffering and the difficulty actually produces life. And it's a good thing. We want to see new generations. We want to see life being brought forth, but there's a discomfort that goes with pregnancy, with gestation, and there's a discomfort that comes with bringing forth the next generation. And there's also discomfort in that the young thrive and grow, Now, they thrive and grow under the care of the parent, and the parent often has to do without food in order to provide for the young so that they can grow and thrive. And then eventually, the result of that is that they leave and don't return. And again, for parents, there's a struggle with that, and yet at the same time, the pain is something that is redemptive because you want your kids to grow up and to go out and make their way in the world. You want them to be, you know, people that can go and have their own families and so on. But yet in the life that you're bringing forth, there's struggle and there's pain in that. And so God's saying that there's this, you can see it in creation all around us, that there is redemptive suffering in the way we conduct, in the way life happens. But we wouldn't want it another way. We wouldn't want to not go through that. And yeah. Because as we can see in the next section, it says, "Who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied its ropes? I gave it the wasteland as its home, the salt flats as its habitat. It laughs at the commotion in the town. It does not hear the driver's shout. It ranges the hills for its pasture and searches for any green thing." So we see that it's God who has created these wild donkeys, and he's created them so that they would despise order and activity, which is what we see in the city. And so really, I mean, the city, in terms of the context of when this was written, there weren't cars and stuff. People got around on donkeys. Jesus, you know, rode on a donkey. Mary rode on a donkey. So donkeys were put to work. We don't see many donkeys working here in Australia. I'm sure there are some. And, you know, that's all good. But we've got to understand when this was written. But the point that he's bringing out is that the wild donkeys despise the discipline that goes with working with humans. Okay? That they don't want to be caught. They don't want to do what they're told. They want to be wild and out doing their own thing. And in doing so, they end up living in the wasteland and in the salt bush, and they spend their days trying to find anything green to eat. So there's this thing where God's communicating that, first of all, yes, there's suffering that's associated with bringing forth new life, but there are people who try and avoid suffering and discipline in any form, that they don't want to be disciplined, they don't want to be put to work. But the fruit of that is not freedom. Even though they feel that they're free, like the wild donkey does, it's not really free because it's bound to wander the wasteland looking for anything green. And when the seasons are hard, there's no provision for it. Whereas the donkeys that submit themselves to masters in the city, when the times are difficult, they've got food and shelter in their stables because they've been willing to suffer through the discipline of not being free. And that discipline and that struggle actually produces protection and safety. So by submitting to the, if I can say, the suffering, to the discipline, they actually find freedom, because they don't have to spend their days looking for just anything green to eat. Proverbs 13:18 says, "Whoever disregards discipline comes to poverty and shame, but whoever heeds correction is honoured." And so again, we have this picture of redemptive suffering, where for those who are willing to submit themselves to a master, to come under discipline, that there's freedom in that. That we never... You know, as Paul says, we're never actually really free. There's no such thing as free, as complete freedom, because we're either slaves to sin, that we're, you know, following whatever we desire to do, in which case it leads to death, or we're slaves to God, who, while we submit ourselves to his law, to his way of living, that provides freedom. So, you know, we're never actually free, but we do get to choose what our bondage is going to be, okay? Can I put it that way? So if we if we think ourselves free, we end up bound to sin and bound to destruction. But if we would bind ourselves to Christ, then we find ourselves being set free. But the freedom comes with provision and liberty, and you know, it's a different kind of freedom. And you know, you sort of hear this, people say, oh, it's a free world, I can do what I want. Well, no, you can't, because if you do what you want, you're going to find your world getting smaller and smaller. But for those of us, for those who restrict themselves and don't do whatever they want and, you know, take on the responsibilities of life, then there's freedom that comes by accepting those responsibilities. And that's what we see in this situation with the wild donkey. It says, then the wings of the ostrich flap joyfully, though they cannot compare with the wings and feathers of the stork. She lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them, that some wild animal may trample them. She treats her young harshly, as if they were not hers. She cares not that her labour was in vain, for God did not endow her with wisdom or give her a share of good sense. Yet when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider. So the ostrich is a bird that is endowed with beauty. You know, ostrich feathers are fairly fancy, aren't they? That's sort of what's presented in the scriptures here, that, you know, they can flap joyfully, you know, because of their fancy feathers. But they're not mindful of their young at all. Now, I don't know whether ostriches are really mindful of their young, but what God's communicating is that they just lay their eggs on the ground. They don't provide a nest or anywhere safe for them. They just leave them on the ground. And so anything can come along and take them. And not only that, but they're really swift to run, and they can outrun anything. And they run pretty quickly, so that if any danger comes, they're off. And they're protecting themselves and fleeing from the danger. So it's talking about some people are so caught up with themselves and so unwilling to endure suffering that they'll disregard those that they're meant to be disciplining themselves to take care of. So as a parent, you know, as we talked about, we saw the pain of bringing children into the world and raising them and seeing them become independent. Some people are not willing to endure the suffering that goes with giving life and bringing blessing to someone else. And so that's what the ostrich is there to represent. And that if any trouble or any suffering comes, they're off. They just take off. And, you know, sadly we see this a lot in society where parents, you know, if life, things get tough at home, they're just off. You know, don't want to deal with the difficulties going on because they're not willing to face the redemptive suffering. So when suffering comes, they flee, but it produces a suffering of its own because there's a loneliness and an isolation that comes with that. He says, do you give the horse its strength or clothe its neck with a flowing mane? Do you make it leap like a locust, striking terror with its proud snorting? It paws fiercely, rejoicing in the strength, and charges into the fray. It laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. These aren't your horses, Gail. Your horses are afraid of everything. it's talking about war horses. The quiver rattles against its side, along with the flashing spear and lance. In frenzied excitement, it eats up the ground. It cannot stand still with the when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, it snorts. Aha! It catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry. So here we're getting these pictures of how animals approach suffering, and what it's doing is reflecting the way people approach suffering. So we've got the deer and the so on willing to suffer to give new life, so there's a redemptive suffering there. And then we've got the donkey, the wild donkey that wants to avoid suffering, so thinks itself free, but is actually bound up and suffers as a result of that. We've got the ostrich, which tries to avoid suffering by giving up its responsibilities and fleeing whenever suffering comes. And here we have the warhorse that actually loves suffering and runs towards suffering in battle, having no fear. So it's not afraid of suffering, but they're a danger to themselves because they don't fear battle. They don't fear consequences. And in doing so, they wreak trouble. That they're reckless in the way that they live. And they go, oh, I don't care if I suffer. But there's a they leave a trail of suffering behind them as they go because they're not really, you know, they're always looking for a fight, always looking for a battle. They're not scared of the difficulties that come with the battle, but they're not careful either of those around them. They just want to get on with it and, you know, get in there. And there's not a redemptive thing about that necessarily either. It says then, does the hawk take flight by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle soar at your command and build its nest on high? It dwells on a cliff and stays there at night. A rocky crag is its stronghold. From there it looks for food, its eyes detect it from afar. Its young ones feast on blood, and where the slain are, there it is. And so here we've got hawks and eagles that go to great lengths to remove themselves from any source of suffering. So they're able to scale high, you know, fly up into high cliffs, and they lay their nests up there to make sure that the young are protected and so on. But from that position, they look out and look for suffering so that they can go and feed on it. And so here we have a picture of people who will use their resources to avoid suffering and shore themselves up against suffering, but at the same time they look out, and when others are suffering, they're quick to come and make a profit from that, or to, you know, gain some advantage from the misfortune of others. And again, this is not a redemptive picture of suffering. So really, when we come to chapter 39, even though it reads like a nature documentary, it actually holds up a mirror to society and says, look, here's a range of ways that people tend to deal with suffering. That they'll either come under the discipline of suffering that will produce life, so they'll work with redemptive suffering, and they'll enjoy that process because of the fruit that it produces. Or they'll try and avoid suffering, and there's many different strategies there to try and get away from suffering, but they all actually end up ultimately leading in more suffering. Or people try and benefit from the suffering of others, which is obviously not a godly thing either. And so God is probing Job, and he's saying, look, you know, let's just stop and consider this thing a bit more broadly. Let's get out of the farm, out into the wild, where, you know, we live in a fallen world, and the world we live in is not a farm. There's a lot of unpredictability. It's a wild and dangerous place that, you know, things happen, and, you know, we can either try and deal with it on our own terms, like the animals do in this passage, or we can submit ourselves to God's purposes. I missed one. Where's the wild ox? Did I jump over that? Oh, thanks. Let's go back to the wild ox. If you've got the King James, it's a unicorn. Yeah, that's right. Just different translation. They reckon they found it. Is that right? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, which is what's reflected in Job here. That the wild ox, or the unicorn, possibly, it says, will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will it stay by your manger at night? Can you hold it to the furrow with a harness? Will it till the valleys behind you? Will you rely on it for its great strength? Will you leave the heavy work to it? Can you trust it to haul in your grain and bring it to your threshing floor? So here we see that the wild ox has strength to do work. It's got the capacity to do the hard stuff to produce life. But it won't. It's got the capacity but doesn't have the inclination to submit to a master, to be useful. And here we're looking at those who, I guess, are blessed in whatever way, whether that be gifts or abilities or resources, but they really are not willing to put those things to useful service. And so they've got the gift, but not the character, and as such are not to be trusted with resources. That it would be, and again, it's kind of similar to the wild donkey, except the wild donkey kind of is, how do you say it, kind of ignorant, I guess, in one sense. It doesn't, you know, not interested, doesn't want to sort of do anything, you know, is idle, I guess is the word. But the wild ox or the unicorn has the capacity to work, that there's potential there to work, but it just won't submit itself to it because it doesn't want to do the hard stuff, even though it could quite easily do the hard stuff. And again, it's a form of avoidance when, you know, not wanting to step up and accept the gifts that we've got because it's going to be hard and it's going to create struggle for us. And so we don't have the redemptive blessing that would come from the suffering by the wild ox submitting itself to a master to produce good fruit. Have I missed any others? Did I skip over any others? Okay. And so as we're looking at all of these, I guess, you know, what we do, as we read the scriptures read us. And we're called to consider what is our response to suffering. Do we lean into the suffering to see a redemptive result? Or do we withdraw from it? Do we hide from it? Do we race into it carelessly and, you know, hang the consequences? Or, you know, are we people that really, you know, sort of sit back and, you know, as long as my world's okay, you know, that's all good and there's suffering over there. How can I, you know, does that work to my advantage? If it does, then, you know, let's go with that. You know, there's a lot of different ways that people approach suffering. Or are we like Christ who would, who gave up the riches of heaven to come down and suffer on earth as a man, as Mick said this morning in communion, that it pleased God to see him suffer to work redemption because it was worthwhile. The difficulty that he endured produced good fruit and it's redemptive. And this is the character that God is wanting to form in us, that we would become like Christ, that we would approach suffering the way that he does by, you know, as we experience suffering, that we lean into God and we find strength from him and we find out what it is that he's trying to lead us through and where the fruit is in all of this. Because God is a God who always works redemption. He always leads to life, regardless of the situation and the circumstance.